The opinions expressed on the following audio program are solely those of the host and the guests. Byrna Podcast is an independently produced, not-for-profit show and is not associated with the Burning Man organization or its subsidiaries. The views expressed are not representative of the entire Burning Man community and are presented here for entertainment purposes only. In short, calm the fuck down. It's just a podcast.
All right, it's episode number 29. It is 215 days till the man burns as of this recording. Hey, I'm going up to Burning Man headquarters in San Francisco. I'm going up there like next weekend. So if you are one of those people who listens to this show like right when the episode comes out and you're in San Francisco, you know, shoot me a tweet or a message on Facebook if we're friends, you know, whatever. Send an email through the burnerpodcast.com contact page and maybe we'll try to meet up. It might be fun. But I'll be out there from like next Thursday through Sunday. It's Valentine's Day weekend. So Thursday and Friday, we have multiple interviews booked over at headquarters with some big names that you're going to be very, very excited about. And I'm not going to tell you who they are just yet. Not because I don't know who they are, or also not because, you know, we don't have interviews booked. We do, I swear. I just in case, you know, I want to tease you. I want you to be excited about the upcoming episodes. But there's some big names. There's some big guys from and gals and gender non-specific individuals over at Burning Man HQ that we're going to sit down and have some wonderful conversations with about this little thing of ours, this community of ours, this big event of ours. It's going to be pretty exciting. I'm pretty excited about that. So, yeah, if you're in the San Francisco area during a Valentine's Day weekend, shoot me a tweet or something. And, you know, who knows? Maybe we'll bump into each other or grab a couple of drinks or whatever else it is you crazy people do up there. You know, it's interesting. Our music editor, Navjeet, he's been pitching the idea of updating our tagline. Because right now it's beyond Burning Man, ... for those who burn the other 350 days a year. It's not like necessarily the most exciting catchphrase or whatever, but it tells you in one sentence what this show is about, because it is aimed more at, you know, like the burners, like people that are just living this life and your social circles are burners, or at the very least you would like more of your social circles to be burners. Perhaps you are that young burner couple in, I guess it doesn't matter how old you are, that burner couple in South Dakota that I keep mentioning. I don't know if this couple exists, but I keep imagining that they're the ones that gather around the bonfire and listen to this show so that they can be a part of these conversations that they would love to be a part of on a regular basis, but they don't have much of a community in their particular region or city or town. And so Nav had been pitching the idea of changing the way that he describes the show is the conversation you didn't have on Playa, or the conversation you missed on Playa. Something like that. I mean, it's a really good tagline. I mean, you know, I'm considering changing it to that, but you know, we'll see. We're definitely going to work that in somewhere. But today's episode is a really wonderful example of that tagline, the conversation that you missed on Playa. It is what we pitched when we decided to record this show as a polyamory roundtable. And you may ask why. Well, some of you might ask why. Most of you probably, you know, get it. Like, this is the kind of shit we talk about all the time. We sat down and we had some meetings between the management staff of this amazing show that you're listening to, and we came up with like a long list of topics that would be of interest to our listenership. And of course, one of them was the subject of polyamory, because like every other person you meet in our community identifies as poly. And of course, poly means very, very different things to very, very different people. You could sit here and debate about the meanings and the different subgenres and all this kind of stuff. And we're going to get into that kind of stuff in the coming conversation. But basically, producer Meg grabbed two very articulate individuals to join us for this chat. And the pitch was that it would just be a casual chat. It's not going to be some major conclusive breakthrough. It's just me and a couple of other people sitting down and shooting the shit about what polyamory is or can be, what it means to you. And our guests today, of course, that you'll hear are Amanda Joy and Greg Young. And this is the interview that you'll be hearing momentarily after I finish blabbing. And I should stress again that this is not like the conclusive episode on polyamory. Like, this isn't like this major breakthrough. It's a very nice chat. I definitely really enjoyed it. But more than anything, I emphasize it is a chat. It is an introduction in regards to this show into that particular topic. And what I wanted to do is just kind of open some dialogue and kind of have some conversation, you know, drink some wine and kind of get some of this stuff started out there. And eventually, we would love to get into more specific angles of polyamory. And we get into that too in some of the conversation, because, you know, right now, I think Greg and Amanda agreed with me on this. The word polyamory is just kind of like this umbrella word for many varieties of consensual non-monogamy, which is sort of the more correct way of describing it. So it's basically a conversation about this particular topic, and we're gonna go ahead and get started on that in just a second. But I really did want to bring up this one point during the conversation that just really keeps making me, whenever I think about it, it makes me like shove my fist into my mouth and bite down on my finger. Like, not in the dirty way, get your heads out of the gutter. But you know, when you like cringe and you're like, oh God, you know, and there was this moment during the interview that you'll hear, and it's quite amusing now looking back. But it was a big learning lesson for me as an interviewer. I'm not gonna lie to you, listener. I've been doing interviews for like 5 years, and I didn't think that there was anything you could throw at me that would be brand new. I'd gotten cocky. I had absolutely gotten cocky. I realized that now looking back. We got into a segment where I didn't realize at the moment that it was happening, because I was just sort of like, you know, in black and white interview mode, but I was kind of like grilling Amanda about the details of her relationship. And I know, if I'm so sorry, I know she's listening and cringing right now, but for the audience, you know, what I do is I'm always looking to ask the questions that I think people might be wanting to ask, and they just might be afraid to ask. Maybe they're embarrassed, maybe they don't want to ask their friends, like, who knows? But I'm sort of trying to put myself in the heads of those people that are listening that might be wondering some silly little details. And I'm not going to tell you exactly what happens in this moment. You'll catch it when it comes up. I you will, because you'll hear her call me out directly. It was interesting. When I'm sitting down and interviewing an individual, there is some judo, there's some chess, if you will. It's happening no matter who I'm interviewing, but especially with an individual, I guess I realized after recording this interview that it's a little different when you're doing multiple people. No pun intended. But when I'm doing it with it, when I'm interviewing an individual person, I am watching sort of like their body language. I'm seeing sort of what they hesitate on, what answers they jump on. And I can sort of like catch on to that branch of the conversation and get into asking some tough questions, but still making the guest feel very comfortable about it. And that's very much a skill that I've honed over many years of doing this. And like I said, I got cocky. And in this particular situation, I realized that because I was juggling two individuals with, of course, extremely high intellects, two very articulate individuals who are very passionate about their place in the world and what they have created as identities and what they've explored as intellectual creatures and entities. And I was trying to juggle two people in this manner, and at the same time trying to get the conversation going. And we have a moment where I ask, I'm asking sort of some very silly questions, and then there's like this moment of like just silence. And let me tell you something, guys, as a podcast host, radio host, whatever, Rule number one, you cannot have silence. You cannot have any awkward silence. And I have this moment where there's like an awkward silence and I kind of panic and I say some really dumb shit. She totally calls me out on it. And I hope we laughed about it correctly, but it's totally makes me cringe to this day. And it was a huge learning lesson. Definitely this episode was a huge growing experience. So as that comes up, sorry if I spent too much time talking about it, but I spent a lot of time thinking about that moment and about this episode and how this topic and any topic when we're dealing with people and their relationships and the way that they live their lives can be potentially much more sensitive than sometimes we give it credit for. And when I say we, I mean me or anybody who could be discussing other people's lives and other people's relationships. So overall, I do hope that this is an enjoyable conversation for you. And overall, you learned some interesting things. Overall, it was lots of fun. We had lots of laughs. We drank wine. I don't think we actually took a break to pee, but but it was overall a really wonderful conversation. I really, really enjoyed it. And Amanda, of course, I'm sorry if I was disrespectful, but not at all the intention. But anyway, we chat about what relationships mean. We get into what they mean to individual people. We get into what brought each of our two amazing guests to where they are today in their lives and how their lives are today and what that could mean for their future relationships. What, if any, connections there might be to yours, dear listener. Let's go ahead and get into it. It is a introductory conversation into the topic of consensual non-monogamy. And I hope you guys enjoy it as much as I did. Today's episode is entitled Lovers Without Borders. That's cute, right? It's not cliche. I hope it's not cliche. I go by Mr. Arash, even though nobody calls me Mr. Welcome to Burner Podcast. To interact with the other as you see it, people outside of your own body, out of your own ecosystem. And then as you start to dive inward, you see that there's this whole other ecosystem you've never even explored. And I can tell you, like, for me personally, once I discovered that that was the case, it just, like, I used to always desire travel. Like, I daydream about traveling to, like, Europe. And I've been to a few different places around the world, but I was obsessed about it. Like, I wish I could just be in Sicily right now. And then, like, the more I discovered the internal, the less I was interested in travel.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
There's so much
I did a location fix so many times in my life before I started to really look inward. Mm. And it's been such a much better process and better results.
Yeah. You know? You were saying, just before we hit record, you were saying that you, when you married, you were a virgin?
Yes.
Ooh, okay. So let's start. Yeah. We're going to start with your background.
Sure.
I know. As soon as you started saying that.
Well, why not? Okay.
We're going to start there.
So, Greg, you were a virgin on your way.
Yeah, what a loser.
Call me, yeah.
It's got to be unusual.
How fucked up is that?
we're going to get, like, kind of a quick history on your backgrounds and sort of, like, where you guys are at right now in your lives.
Sure.
And then, we'll see where the conversation goes.
Okay. So let's start, Greg. Virgin, wedding night, go.
and I had 16 years of Catholic indoctrination and education, but mostly indoctrination. You know, all the way from an all-boys Catholic high school, which really screws up your social life, and then the University of Notre Dame, which was a great education, but, you know, was also kind of cloistered. And so, yes, I was a virgin on my wedding night, incredibly naive, as was my wife. And we decided during our honeymoon that, oh, no, this marriage is not going to last, so let's give it 2 years and see if love develops, but not have any kids. So it lasted 2 years. We ended it. A couple years later, I met my life partner-to-be. It's how I like to describe her. In a choir that we were both singing in. And I had a couple of girlfriends, and I wasn't just, you know, a little bit more experienced then. But it became, you know, she became my life partner almost immediately. I had this immediate intuition that this is going to, we're going to go through life together in some way. So we moved to Hawaii, bought a coffee farm, lived on the coffee farm, had our kids over there, twin boys that are now coming on 30 years this year. And
what year did you meet her?
Met her in 1982.
Okay. That was the year I was born.
I'm an old geezer. I may not look quite that old, but I am. But seriously, I mean, like going on 30, my own kids, is just astonishing that could happen.
Yeah. So your partner, when you guys met, were you guys immediately both on the same page as far as the idea of not traditional monogamy?
You know, I don't think we even talked about it at that time. Because I don't think in 1982 the word poly was not frequently known. I mean, there were swingers for sure, you know, and that was even its own undercurrent and its own underground. But we just got married and then we didn't even think about that, and we played with a couple of other people along the way. But we didn't get emotionally involved with anybody outside the marriage. We had, you know, we were both faithful emotionally and sexually to the marriage for a long time, except for those, here's this other couple, this will be fun. Mm-hmm. And we did that. But it was not an emotional movement to open up the marriage. It was just, this would be fun to go play with these people.
Yeah.
But then when I went to Burning Man in 2003, it was my first burn. When I came back, the two of us fell into a foursome with another burner couple that started off more swinging, but then the emotional context started to grow, and we each fell in love with one another, and suddenly it was a different thing, and that's when we started to both more actively explore what it meant to have a non-traditional, non-monogamous relationship. Mm-hmm. But that included emotional, you know, emotional exploration and not just sexual exploration.
Yeah. Were you a virgin when you got married?
I have never been married. Don't ever plan to be married. And, yeah, no. Would not be.
You're not a virgin.
Well, let's go with your short bio. Like, your first major relationship, how old were you?
Well, I suppose my first boyfriend in the very, like, childhood, you know, when I was in middle school, I actually ended up in a relationship with for 4.5 years, which I get is super weird. Yeah. I still would not call that my first major relationship.
Was he in middle school?
Okay. It was an age-appropriate, normal middle school relationship. Mm-hmm. I just think it's unusual that people at that age stay together for that long.
What's yours to you for pulling it off? Successful middle school relationship.
I guess the first thing I consider or I think of as like my sort of first adult relationship is probably also the first relationship where we were reciprocally and openly non-monogamous. Monogamy never made sense to me. I had never heard of anyone who wasn't. I didn't know it was a thing. I didn't really hear the term polyamory probably till 2010, actually. But never throughout my life was it anything that made sense to me. And so I always just had conversations with the people I was in relationships with about what I thought I wanted and what they wanted and what I was willing to negotiate and those kinds of things. But the first time I was willing to really say, this is who I am, this is non-negotiable, this, you know, the sort of normal expectations about how to do relationships don't work for me was about 2001, 2002. And I ended up with that partner for several years until I moved to California in 2005. And we were open the whole time and everyone thought we were insane. And then when I moved here, I had a partner who I lived with and was open with, and everyone thought we were insane for a long time. Until finally in 2010, I met a community of people who didn't think it was insane, which was pretty life-changing.
That is pretty amazing. Even for both of you, it's in the grand scheme of things, it's relatively new in culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard you say you always knew that this, you know, you were, that the monogamy constraint wasn't going to work with
right.
you. And I think I knew that as well. Matter of fact, I've been trying to find out if there's good research on is there any kind of indication that it's a genetic tendency, or we're either born monogamous or born non-monogamous, as one might have a sexual orientation. And I haven't found really strong research on that yet, just a lot of blogs who think it's that way. Mm-hmm. And a great book that's just a compilation of stuff called Sex at Dawn, which mm-hmm. I really love.
Yeah, I've referenced that book multiple times.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't give us concrete mm-hmm. answers on that either. It just gives you lots of correlatives. But I also felt, okay, I don't understand why that's a constraint. And, you know, when we started playing, it didn't seem to be either an ethical or inherently frightening concept that we would play. But it still brings emotional complexity. There's no doubt about that. I mean, it's harder to be poly in the sense that you have to be much more consciously aware of, first of all, your own feelings, and then more than one other person. And that is that it brings wonderful benefits, but it does require a great deal more focus. And yeah. we spend a ton of time processing, mm-hmm. Just a ton.
Yeah. Yeah. Obviously, again, I can stress this for our listeners. These are, you know, like the beginning of the show says, these are just opinions. obviously we're only three people in the room, so, you know, don't, tweet me nasty things. But, I've felt like, and I'm very, very new to this field, just so you guys sort of know my background on this. I started to explore the polyamory community before I discovered the burn community. And it was specifically, I was coming out of my long-term relationship. I was in a six-year relationship, and it was it was basically like an emotional six-year coke bender. Just extreme highs, extreme lows. We're very addicted to each other. But coming out of it, you know, especially like in the last year we're together, I'd really become obsessed with becoming the best partner that I could be. So I was mm-hmm. learning all these things about myself, and I really was happy with who I was, and I did become the partner that I was proud to be. But at that point, so much damage had already been done that it was kind of irreversible at that point. But I came out of that relationship, and the one thing that was still very much in the forefront of my psyche was jealousy. Mm-hmm. Felt extreme, extreme jealousy. And I would feel it in my body. My face would flush. And I could literally point to you where in my stomach I would feel it. And I am a visual artist, so when I imagine her with somebody else, it's in detailed description. I know exactly where he's holding her and where he's coming on her and the music that's playing in the background. I mean, every detail, the lighting in there. So I'm experiencing all this, and I remember I'm in the middle of going through these kinds of things, and I would stop and I'd think like, yeah, but I don't logically agree with any of that. Like, that's just her and her body, and I've done plenty of dirty shit in my time, so like, where's this coming from? And I remember I had this epiphany, like, it felt like I was the Power Ranger sitting inside of the giant robot. And I'm, like, pressing buttons for the giant robot to do things, and it's not doing what I'm telling it to do. And that's what I felt like the jealousy was. I'm like, I don't agree with this. I don't agree with this at all, and yet I'm feeling it in my system. Therefore, I wonder if consciousness is different than the human body. And that was my first step towards the spiritual place that I'm at now. Mm-hmm. At that time, I was, you know, I identified as agnostic, but I was pretty much atheist. I was looking for something. I couldn't feel it, and that was the first thing that got me there. And that's when I started to explore polyamory, because I'm like, okay, well, here's a community that has got something figured out here. Or at least they're having a discussion. Like, they're having some dialogue about what it is. And it's funny, because both of you guys had this face right now, like, let's talk about jealousy, because jealousy, that is the very first thing that people, of course, anybody who's not familiar with the community, with polyamory even, that is at the forefront, because they're like, you can't even conceive of the idea of sharing the person that supposedly belongs to you and they're supposed to only have eyes for you with somebody else, because the jealousy, this pain is so overwhelming and it so overtakes your body. And so I guess one of the things that you're saying, like the people who practice polyamory, who identify as polyamorous, some would say, as you were saying earlier, that you're either kind of born with it or you're not. And the ones that say that just weren't born with it seem to have less of that jealousy gene. What do you think about that?
I really don't like that, I have to say. I've always sort of found it a little bit puzzling, and I think that this makes me maybe in some ways a bad candidate to answer this question, but I've always found it a little bit puzzling why people think that jealousy is so much harder for polyamorous relationships than for monogamous relationships. It seems to me that jealousy is something that is, you know, it has to be grappled with by everyone. And I think what you said about being able to like feel it in your body and know yourself very well, that's an awesome first step to being able to grapple with it really well, is being able to identify it in yourself, because that's how you can learn to process it in a way that isn't destructive to you or the people you care most about. I think that's true no matter what, whether it's, you know, job, career jealousy or relationship jealousy or familial jealousy, you know, whatever kind of jealousy it is. Yeah. I think that's true.
So you've, and that's sort of the difference between you guys. You've always kind of identified as not monogamous. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah.
Your youth? Yes. And you came to it a little bit later in your life.
A little bit, during my long marriage, we both realized this, you know, we were not monogamous.
Yeah. Yeah. So the listeners know, producer Meg kind of threw the two guests in today without telling me much about their background.
Hi, Amanda.
So this is interesting.
We've never met either. So
yeah,
none of the three of us. I had met.
No.
Or you.
Perfect.
So did you
at any point in your life have that conversation with yourself about the difference between your identity of self versus the human body you inhabit? How you've experienced jealousy.
So earlier I was talking about dropping out of my PhD program. That was in philosophy. So that's kind of...
All right.
That was sort of an unfair question. Yes, I have had that conversation with myself and hundreds of students, in fact. I do think that... I think that you know, getting to sort of understand that you have reactions that you don't necessarily endorse is certainly something that's always been important to me. And that's not, you know, jealousy is not the only place we get those.
What was the first time that you remember having that conversation with yourself?
I think that I've probably been having that conversation longer back than my memory goes, honestly. I think it's just always a big part of how I process everything. But this kind of touches on what you said earlier, when you said the polyamory community has some things figured out.
Yeah.
I kind of had that hope when I first met them. Yeah, I mean, and I think this kind of gets to one of the issues that I have been, I guess I want to say, like, most disappointed by in the polyamory communities, and there's not one of them, of course, there's lots of different ones, that I've known, in that I've seen this social thing happen that I think is really destructive for people's relationships, where there gets to be this notion of jealousy that it's unhealthy and it's irrational, and I divorce it from myself, you know, in that way that, sure, I might have those impulses, but I don't endorse them, and therefore I just have to squelch them or something, or they're my problem. And I think that that's really damaging. I think that, you know, jealousy isn't just my problem necessarily, right? I also have a responsibility to discuss it with my partners or anybody who is involved in that. That doesn't mean that they're responsible for my feelings, but as people who care for one another and are in each other's lives, I think it's important to not just try to squelch those things and call them unhealthy, but to try to deal with them in a healthy way, which involves acknowledging them and talking about them and having the people you care about also acknowledge them and be willing to negotiate with you about them.
How often do you think you feel jealousy? Ballpark.
Like at all?
Sure.
Or about sex?
About your partners. In regards to, yes, sex. So let's assume that you're not, like, chasing after the same philosophy doctorate.
Well, I don't... I mean, I think that there's... This is, I guess... I don't do a lot of reading about polyamory, but this is something that I've recently seen more writing about, where some people, I think, are more prone to sexual jealousy, whereas other people are more prone to what's usually called emotional jealousy. I don't know that I want to strongly endorse that division, but I think it is important.
Sure.
I don't think I experience sexual jealousy very often, but I do experience emotional jealousy. And I think for people like that, they probably feel jealousy over their friends often. You know, if your close friends seem like they bond with each other over something that you're left out on, that's kind of the same thing as happens with your partners.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I feel that a lot, all the time. It's just usually fleeting.
I've discovered in myself that, and I can't speak for anybody else, but jealousy for me is an expression that some need is not being met. Now, I may project that that need needs to come from the partner that I'm feeling jealous about, but that isn't necessarily the case. If I'm feeling, oh, she's off with another guy tonight, and I'm feeling unhappy, and I'm going to go down to the basic, I'm sad, you know, without extending it to jealous or whatever, that is not me necessarily because she's doing something else. It's because I'm not getting a need met that night, in that moment. If I were with another partner that night, I know from my own experience, I would not be thinking about her at all. Mm. Matter of fact, if I were thinking about her, I'd be thinking, oh, that's cool. She's having a good time too. And to me, it's a matter of feeling out of balance that your needs are not being met in your relationship at that very moment, and you haven't figured out how to take care of yourself. Or, you know, you haven't communicated about, this is an issue for me. Doesn't mean it's you can resolve it, but it doesn't, it's I don't see it as I agree with what you said. It happens. You shouldn't try to suppress it, but you should, but for me, it's look inside and find out, well, if I'm feeling that, she's doing, like what you were describing, I can see just where he's holding her, and what's really going on? Mm-hmm. Is it because I'm angry that she's having pleasure? No. It's because I'm angry or sad because I'm not getting what I want right now, which may not just be her. I just may want a blowjob right now. Mm-hmm. Very simply. I'm sitting at home by myself and I'm feeling lonely. That's what it is. It's not necessarily some possession kind of a thing. Which is where I think our society defines jealousy, is it is the expression of possession that has been broken. I possess you, therefore you are not allowed to do this because I get jealous about it. And to me, that whole mode of thinking doesn't work at all.
Yeah. As you were describing that, you actually gave me this epiphany because one of the first things that you learn as you start to explore concepts of polyamory, and, you know, I like to actually describe it as just like non-monogamy because
I prefer that also.
Yeah, let's use non-monogamy. Polyamory is tell me if you guys agree with this or not. I feel like right now it's being used as an umbrella term for various different ways of practicing non-traditional classic monogamy.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like, actually even Berner. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, it's an umbrella term. We have a lot of different communities in the burner community, and it's just kind of a nice way to say, hey, you know what? This is a group that's agreed to, like, not fuck with each other. You can, you can do your thing as long as you're not hurting me. So polyamory, I definitely see that. And what attracts me to polyamory, I mean, initially it was dealing with jealousy and also trying to understand my own feelings, my own sexual desires outside of my partnerships. But as I got deeper into it, and I find the people that I tend to connect with who, find the approach interesting, is that it is about learning more about self.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the pathways to learning more about yourself and where you come from and how you became who you are is through exploring your sexuality. And the part where the epiphany came in is in our society, especially because we're so heavily influenced by the Abrahamic religions, sexuality is seen as like this, you know, this no-no thing, this petty thing. Like, so even as you're describing that, there is a part of my mind, the default world part of it, that was like, that's kind of petty, like kind of thinking about blowjobs while you're trying to like build a relationship. But it's true. Like that is a part of like, that is a part of who we are. It is a part of our human needs and our sexual desires and how we interpret sexuality and how we interpret intimacy traces back to the deepest parts of who we are, the wounded child inside of us and the person that we've become today and how we interact with the world. Sex is important. It's like a lot of times I'll meet people that, this is very common, like my female friends, not in our circles, will say, I've heard this sentence many times, God, everything's really great with him and he's really wonderful. The sex is kind of, it could be better. I'm like, whoa, that's a really big deal. Like, that says a lot about how open and intimate you are in my observation and my experience. It's what I call like your jugular moment. Like when an animal shows you their jugular and they're absolute most intimate. So how a person has sex says a lot about where they are and what they're opening up and what they're showing. Yeah. So that's really fascinating because we immediately go to that place. And I think that's probably why the same questions that a lot of the default world has about homosexuality, it's the same thing. Their mind immediately goes to like, well, it's just about sex. And I wonder, like, if you guys can elaborate on sort of like your thoughts on that. Like when you're having these discussions with yourself about polyamory, or I'm sorry, about non-monogamy, how much of that is sex in your internal dialogue and how much of it is just about like what you were describing, for example, emotional jealousy versus physical jealousy?
Okay. It's not all about sex. For me, I'm more likely to be triggered into jealousy by the emotional content, the emotional bonds that my lovers have with other people. Right. So if I'm a solo poly, if you will, I'm single. I am not partnered with anyone. I'm not in, you know, when we get into these terms of primary and secondary, and frankly, we could probably go on all night about that. But I'm not in a singular relationship that has a hierarchy with anybody right now. And that's the first time in my life that I've been in that state, because I was married and then partnered twice after that. And I can, from my experience, it was much more challenging to think of someone that I loved as loving someone else more than thinking of them as fucking somebody else and having good sex. Because the way my life has been in that I see love as something that once I love someone, especially once it's a romantic, deeper connection, in whether or not we have sex, but especially if we have bonded at the heart and where we look into one another's eyes and we are willing to share anything about ourselves and feel heard in that. That's the core, such a core part of love for me, that if I feel that the other person is spending putting her emotional self into another relationship far great more than she is with me, I don't feel that my need for intimacy is being met. And that, to tell you the truth, is a lot scarier for me. I have three lovers right now. We have great sex. They are in a very different and very different people, and that's wonderful. Yet the levels of emotional of trust and intimacy in each of those relationships are different, and I know that one of them she spends a lot more time with someone that she's been with for years. And yet I have a non-sexual relationship with my now ex-wife, the person I describe as my life partner, mother of our children, and yet we have great trust. And so for me, the emotional element is far stronger, and it will hit me harder. I feel like, oh, she's, you know,
really stuck.
The value of tribe is way, way understated.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
I was thinking about earlier the progression into patriarchy from what most societies were matriarchal prior to agriculture. And once again, going back to one of my favorite books, Sex at Dawn. And that, you know, most of those societies didn't have a concept of paternity. Mm-hmm. Sex was for fun. Babies happened. Everybody raised the kids. The kids had multiple role models. You know, there were males and females. The females had breasts, so they fed the babies. You know, and they certainly had gendered division of labor. But the idea of the nuclear family or the bonded monogamous couple completely didn't exist in most of these societies, and in some still does not. So are we returning in this non-monogamy to what may be in our much longer history of prehistory, our much longer period as prehistoric beings before we started to write down and own everything, to what is our natural state of being? I don't know. That's the theory that Sex at Dawn puts forward. I kind of buy into it, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about, that one person is not, I don't know if I believe that, but when I hear that from many people, and these are more than one person that I trust, mm-hmm. I start to realize, this is something I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And I need to look at it.
Right.
Now, Sex at Dawn, correct me if I'm wrong, it makes the argument that the evolutionary psychology behind our practicing monogamy came when we settled down and started to build cities and societies. And we kind of wanted to know how we're passing our property down, because before that we didn't really have property. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, the people, the genes that continue to pass forward were the ones where there was like a continuing sense of property, like this belongs to me, this is mine. So I understand that that's sort of like
One of the main theses, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Which is interesting, because you still do have tribal cultures in various parts of the world that don't practice monogamy the way that we do, mm-hmm. here in the westernized cultures. Mm-hmm. There's one tribe that, I don't remember which one it was. I talked about it in my anthropology class in college. It said like on the wedding night, they laid down all these leaves in the center of the village, and then every man in the tribe would climb onto the woman prior to the actual groom finally getting a shot. Idea being that, you know, that child could potentially be anything that belongs to anybody belongs to everybody. Sort of some of the ideas behind it. Mm-hmm. But of course, being that we live in these like westernized cultures, a lot of quote unquote the mainstream, whether they realize it or not, they look at that kind of culture and they see it as like, you know, the image of the savage, like these are not advanced human beings. Look where we are. I live in a building, and I shower, so that means I know more than you. But it's interesting to see that, you know, you still do have these different little pockets of culture in different parts of the world that don't necessarily agree 100%.
Burner Podcast.
Okay, so yeah, a very important little note about this episode. You'll notice we're taking our break a little bit earlier. Normally it comes in like halfway through the conversation-ish, kind of around that time. That is because this episode did experience some technical difficulties. Some of the files had some issues while saving and exporting and all that. So couldn't tell you. there's like a few words that are missing sort of on where this little section of the conversation went. I don't remember where it went, but it wasn't a big deal. The main thing is all the way at the end of the episode, usually we have this kind of like warm and fuzzy part where I kind of like thank the guests for like putting themselves out there and all that good stuff. And that part is cut off. The episode ends with a bit of a cliffhanger. We start this thought and I considered ending the interview like a little bit sooner so that you don't even hear that last question that I asked, but I think that Greg had some really fascinating input on it and I wanted to leave that in there, but it does end on a little bit of a cliffhanger note, you'll notice. But we're gonna get back to this topic. This is definitely a topic that we are going to return to in future episodes, and we will explore that last bit more. So in case, since it's not there and you're not going to get to hear it, of course, thank you so much to Amanda and Greg for being such amazing guests and willing to put themselves out there for your, I don't know, growth, for your entertainment, for your amusement, for your discussion points, for all that good stuff. We really do appreciate you guys, and it was, thank you so much for coming on. I really did enjoy doing this this episode. So, all right, let's get back to the show. There's about 40 something minutes of it left, and then it ends with like dun dun dun. Oh, and then if you are one of those people who does listen to that, you know, ending show credits section, you might hear me reference the fact that I mentioned some things here in this middle break. That's because in the original recording of this middle break, I told you guys that you can go listen to this on TuneIn.com, on Stitcher Radio, on iTunes, on a variety of other apps that I've lost track of. That you can follow all that stuff over at burnerpodcast.com. And I asked you to, you know, leave us some comments and some reviews. We'd appreciate that. So, yeah, I referenced that all the way at the end in the outro because I mentioned it here, but then I had to re-record this middle part. How exciting is it that you have this information now? You can now live your life and wake up tomorrow and go to work now that you know this. Ah, good Lord. All right, let's get back to the show.
Welcome home.
She did say that multiple other people approached...
We're talking about producer Meg, listeners.
multiple other people told her, like, how come I didn't get picked for this one?
Oh, really?
Really?
Yeah.
That's funny.
Because she talks. I have a question. So how do you feel about veto power?
Two thumbs down.
Absolutely.
Four thumbs down.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where do you think that comes from?
Where does veto power come from, or where does my reaction to it?
Both.
I think, where do I think it comes from? I guess, I mean, in part, I think it comes from, you know, monogamy being the sort of, well, I guess I should say monogamy. I think in part it comes from us living in a culture that has a lot of couples privilege built into it, even more than, you know, monogamy being the default. And so if you have this couples privilege system, then one way to preserve that is to say, you know, there's a sort of sacredness of the couple, and anything that threatens that, the couple itself has domain over making decisions about, even if the thing that threatens it is, say, another human being that should have some self-determination. And so I think, I guess it comes from that. And then also, you know, people having insecurity and not thinking through the way their mechanisms for dealing with their insecurity are perhaps hurting other people because they live in a society that's steeped in couples privilege and where monogamy is the default and those kinds of things. And so it just feels sort of justified to, you know, do whatever sorts of things, even if it's not necessarily veto power, but to have the kind of couples, you know, preserving the couple's responses that can be really hurtful to other people. And I think that's hard. I think that's hard even for those of us who, I think we agree on this, really, really deeply reject hierarchical structures to relationships, still it comes up. I mean, I catch myself having that kind of couple's privilege thought, even though I don't endorse it at all. You know, it still happens.
Are you in a relationship that you would characterize as a primary relationship?
I would not use that word because I reject hierarchies.
Right.
But it's obviously
does that
somewhat
other
semantic.
Person think that?
No. Okay, that other person also rejects hierarchies.
Okay. But you see it comes up anyway.
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm in a relationship with someone where, like, we know each other's families and we spend more nights a week together than not,
right,
and way more time with each other than the other people we're dating, even though we have a third person that we're in a triad with. And so, you know, if you asked either of us if we were primaries, we would both go, oh, no. But
right.
I wouldn't be shocked if I overheard someone describing us as that.
Yeah. For the listeners, do we have this, not that everyone adheres to it, but this concept of primary and secondary in a lot of non-monogamous relationships. Think of a hierarchical relationship, you know, hierarchical tiers in their relationships, and you have one or maybe more than one primary partner. And everybody else is secondary or even tertiary if you're in a pod. And I know some people that are in like 20-person pods where there is a single primary. Yeah, single primary and a couple of secondaries, but all these other play partners. that are considered to have really, you know, important roles in the overall family, but aren't involved in the decision making about who fucks whom. Mm-hmm. To put it rather bluntly, because it's not as simple as that. And, you know, I was in three partnered non-monogamous relationships, and in all three of those, my partner expected that, and I'm oriented straight. I'm pansensual, but I'm oriented straight. So all of my partners have been women, and they all believe that they should have veto power. Now I'm single or non-partnered, and that always grated on me. And now I just won't even touch it. Mm-hmm. If someone really wants to be with me, who wants to have that kind of, who needs that kind of control, if we can't get to meeting that underlying need in some other way than by her dictating whom I am going to be with, then we are going to have a very difficult time resolving our relationship.
Yeah. It's honestly never come up for me. I think I was deeply against it before I learned the term. I can't imagine. I really just can't imagine being in a relationship with anyone who made a decision for me about non-them. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. That really seems unimaginable to me.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. The reason for me it came up was recently I was having a conversation with a good friend who has an open marriage. They have three lovely daughters, and they're extremely happy and... Mm-hmm. Really a wonderful couple to see as an example of successful relationships. They also have a lot of fun bringing in multiple other people. And I was telling him about a relationship that I had just began to engage in. And I thought when it began that this was going to be my first real go at it, like real go at a non-monogamous coupling. And his first advice was, yeah, you should definitely have a veto power. Like, both of you should have that over each other. Era's like, oh, I don't know how I feel about that. Because it's not to say, like, I don't know, my thought on it would be, if my partner is uncomfortable with me connecting with somebody else, okay, we should have a discussion about that. And, like, out of respect for my partner, I wouldn't just say, like, you know, fuck you, I'm going to go do what I want anyway. but I feel like that rigidness, it does really go back to sort of what you're describing, which is like and that actually does make us wonder, like, is there some wiring, or is that still just culture having beaten that into our heads?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, it's equally unimaginable to me to consider making a decision that will affect a person I love and not finding out how they feel about it and having that weigh heavily in my decision. So, I mean, that to me, like, that, what do you need a veto for? Like, that to me is the important thing.
Yes. Yeah. That was so beautifully stated. I was going to ask, okay, so the opposite of this veto power might be, we just don't talk about it. Yeah. The don't ask, don't tell thing. Oh, that is terrible.
Yeah.
Because you're at least carrying the emotional experience from that other person into this other relationship. You're more than one person very often. It's affecting you, regardless of whether you want to talk about it or not. When we first met earlier this evening, I said how much I appreciated your discussion about transparency and openness at the beginning of the last podcast. To me, that is the core of the only way this can work. Mm-hmm. If I'm, you know, and I have varying, you know, degrees. I have three lovers right now, and I'm using that in the sexual context. I have a lot of people I love, and I still love, you know, my ex-wife. I think of her as life partner, but I, you know, simply narrowing it down. Mm. They each have different ideas about what it is safe to talk about. One of them is coming from is still in a marriage herself and is trying to work through this. The other one came from a hard breakup marriage. And the third one is very easy. We can talk about anything. But those other two, I'm always at this point of, okay, I you don't want to hear about this too much. I know it threatens you. Now, I don't feel threatened by what you're doing, but you feel threatened by what I'm doing, and you don't want to know about it. To me, that ends up being a withhold. And withholds, in other words, information that you are not talking about, especially when it is your own feelings that you are unwilling or are afraid to talk about in a relationship, is one of the most deleterious things you could do in relationships, and will kill it. Because they build up and they become huge burdens, and when they finally get disclosed, they are explosive. Don't want to have withholds in your relationships. So if you're in a non-monogamous relationship, if you're not able to talk about at least, hey, this happened with her and it kind of hurt, or this happened with her and it was really great, if you're not able to say either of those things to another one of your partners, then something is getting broken, and the wall has started to come up. And that is, it's hard between a monogamous couple, but it becomes a real burden in multi-directional relationships.
Yeah.
I agree. I mean, I think, you know, I have trouble because I think, again, fundamentally self-determination in relationships is like the most important thing. And I've met people who like this don't act, don't tell, don't ask, don't tell thing, I guess. And I can't relate to that. I don't really ever want to be on any side of such an arrangement, but I don't know. I mean, I think some of the difficulty comes up, and I think you hit on this a little bit. You know, we both talked about how hierarchical relationships are not, you know, we don't like those, basically. And this is something I've been thinking about a lot recently, is that I think it's hard to figure out exactly what that means to not have a hierarchical relationship, because, of course, it doesn't mean that all of your relationships look the same. You're going to be closer to some than others. You're going to spend more time with some than others. You're going to have more overlap of ways of processing or of interests or whatever, you know, more time, whatever it is, you know, with some people than with others. And figuring out ways to allow that to happen that don't fall into hierarchy, because I think that we all have a tendency towards that, even if we reject it, or at least I know I do, even though I reject it, I think can be really tricky. Just to plug the only book I've actually fully read on ethical non-monogamy, but that I loved, I mentioned it in the emails, was More Than Two. It's very long. It's a funny book to recommend because most people will definitely not get through it, but there's a blog also. But the section particularly on hierarchical relationships, I found...
Tell the listeners, both books.
More Than Two?
Yeah.
That's the same book. Yeah, okay. That book and the blog.
Okay.
And there's that, yeah, he does have a new book. The More Than Two is co-authored. I remember their first names, Franklin and Eve, but I don't remember their last names. Anyhow, Franklin has a new book out called The Game Changer, which I haven't read yet. But the blog on game changing was good, so presumably the book might be too. But the section in More Than Two about hierarchical relationships I thought was really good and helpful for me. You know, even though I sort of already knew that that was not the kind of relationships I wanted, it helped me think about what it meant to have relationships that look very different from each other but are still not hierarchical. And the good news maybe about that explanation is that they do a really good job with diagrams just explaining the way hierarchical relationships look. So if this is something that like you're interested in figuring out, even just looking at their diagrams, they're all about the way sort of arrows of power and influence flow between people. And, you know, the sort of point of hierarchical relationships is not having the decision-making flow through another person. So even though my connection to you might be way more minimal than my connection to you, if we're measuring in terms of time or topics we talk about or hobbies we share, it's still the case that, you know, person A and B are determining their relationship and person B and C are determining their relationship without, you know, intermediaries of people who aren't involved in those relationships. I don't know. I think the diagrams really help me figure out ways that it goes wrong without us noticing it's going wrong, just in having, you know, other people exert that kind of direct control, which again is really different than someone saying, hey, I'm having feelings about these kinds of things, or this other thing that's happening in your life is impacting me in this way, and I'm kind of struggling with that. How can we solve this problem? I think, you know, that, of course, you want to do, but that's a really different thing than someone saying, you can't do this.
Yeah. I'd like to ask you about forms. Mm-hmm. Because you started to go that way, and you said you were in a triad.
Mm-hmm.
I have never been in a relationship form that has more than two people in relationship. Well, I shouldn't say that. We were in a foursome, but it was like two couples who crossed.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all learning in the process, and it broke up rather painfully. But I've never been in a relationship with, say, two other lovers,
mm-hmm.
or shared someone actively,
mm-hmm.
where I am not just a metamour, but a paramour. Mm-hmm. And those are also non-monogamy terms, or metamour means that you're lover of your lover, but with whom you do not have a relationship.
Wait, hold on. You're a lover?
Your lover's lover with whom you do not have a relationship is a metamour.
Gotcha.
Okay? I don't know why we need these terms. Because we've got brains and we want to define things.
We like to analyze
shit. We like to analyze shit.
Right? Yeah.
But anyway, so you're in what you described as a triad, mm-hmm. but it's non-hierarchical.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not making decisions on the triad as a group.
Mm-mm.
With one person or even the whole.
I certainly hope not.
So how I'm just fascinated by how this works, and I would love to hear.
Me too.
It just does. I don't know. I mean, it's most of the time pretty easy. There have been times where it's not, but it's most of the time pretty easy. And it's a fairly new experience for me. Although I guess, I don't know, I'm bad at time. Maybe it's actually been about a year. And it wasn't, it sort of evolved out of, you know, two people that I was already sort of dating who had kind of dated each other a little bit, but sort of sporadically. And as all of us sort of got closer, you know, we were all in the same place at the same time also, so that it just worked out that a triad sort of evolved out of these sort of independent relationships that already existed between all of the three of us, which I think helps in some ways, where it wasn't as though it was just a couple that started. I've also dated a couple before, which felt really different, actually, than this does.
Were you the classic unicorn in this thing?
I suppose I was, although I wouldn't, I don't know, I feel like maybe I just have some negative connotations with that, which didn't feel in this.
No, it's a pejorative word.
Yeah.
It is in this
What's
context.
The classic unicorn?
Good question.
The unicorn is the single woman that a couple seeks out so that they can both have sex with her.
Oh, okay.
You know, but who will dedicate her life to them.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, which is why it has some negative connotations.
it is not a very stable or realistic thing.
That's one of the sentences in like every other OkCupid profile where a woman says,
"I am not a unicorn."
They usually don't say that directly. Like they'll say like, "Not here for couples. Not going to be your plaything." Like,
but that's what that's the word.
Yeah. Why unicorn? Why do they call it?
Because they're mythical.
Gotcha. Yep. Records aren't real.
Actually, I was best friends with a married couple who had really only ever dated each other, and they decided they wanted to open their marriage. And they knew I was open, and I had been very close to them for a long time, and ended up dating them for a while, and it was great and non-dramatic and fine and not exploitative or coercive at all, and everything was fine. And then they moved away, and I'm sad about it. At the end. I mean, I'm still very close to them, but they live on the East Coast.
So in the triad that you're in currently, males, females?
Myself and another woman and a man.
Okay. So can we talk about some daily routines and like what life is like in a triad?
I guess so.
I have a feeling people will discover, people who don't have an experience with it, as with most of these things, my experience has been that it turns out to be hilariously boring.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, one thing, when the three of us started spending more time together as a triad, this may have just been in our heads, but we felt as though perhaps our immediate circle of friends, I felt nervous around them. I felt like maybe they were uncertain about how to act, or I felt like I was getting the sorts of looks from my immediate circle of friends that I might be used to getting from, you know, broader communities.
When you started to engage in the triad?
Yeah. Which was very surprising, because my immediate circle of friends are, you know, very much like, if you're not harming or coercing anyone, go for it.
Why were you getting those?
I don't know, and it's possible it was just in my head. But okay. I definitely, there was nervousness and tension about it to begin with, because I felt worried about it. And it's possible that people just, it hadn't, there were people in my immediate circle who had been in triads before, but not recently and not sort of publicly in that group.
What were your anxieties about it?
From the out, like, as far as from outsiders?
No, just when you were going into it, what were some of the anxieties that you were feeling?
I honestly don't think I felt anxious at first at all. I think it was just really easy and great for a long time.
But then you still felt like other people were...
Yeah, I think I felt worried. I did feel worried that I would start to feel the same sorts of things I had felt about, you know, when I was in open relationships and all my friends were monogamous couples. But that didn't, I mean, again, I think I felt a little bit of that at first, but it went away pretty quickly.
Okay. Male and another female, mm-hmm. Does he identify as heterosexual?
Yes.
Okay. He's good for him.
No, wait, stop. All right. There's been a lot that I've wanted to call you out on that I've held my tongue on, have to. Good for me. Yeah. Good for her.
Yes.
Good for all three of us.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm sorry. I just had to call that out because I hate that idea so much. It is as equally awesome, if not more so, for me and the other woman as it is for him. And we had a relationship independently with each other for quite a while before either of us started dating him. Well, I don't know. I've kind of been dating him on and off for 5 years. But anyway.
Well, I apologize for offending you.
No, it's fine. I get it. I'm not really offended. I just really want to, like, nip those kinds of things. Please, because...
That is
what well, I thank you for saying that. I know where my my physical orientation is hetero,
mm-hmm.
but my emotional orientation doesn't really make much distinction. Mm-hmm. I love men, a lot of men, just as much as I love a lot of women. I just don't get a hard on from them. It's as simple. It's kind of as simple as that,
right? Yeah.
But it's not like. We can't engage sensually, mm-hmm. we can't engage emotionally, we can't engage intimately with trust. And, and to me, those are the hallmarks of love.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, if one of my partners is in love with someone and there is a willingness to engage, and that's a big question, but if she's with another man, we can form a triad. I probably won't have sex with him.
Mm-hmm.
But I would still consider that a triad if there is that degree of real intimacy,
mm-hmm. sure.
Where we are open. We will talk about anything. Where we can work through things. And but I've never experienced that.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't. Even the foursome we were in, it was like mutual metamors. She was in love with, you know, with me, the other wife, and he was in love with my wife. But I wasn't in love with him, and she wasn't in love with her,
mm-hmm.
and all this. So it really wasn't. It wasn't what I would say would call a polyquad, where everybody would be, to a reasonable extent, in love with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that kind of thing is a very different form,
sure.
than what I've experienced. So that's why I was so curious about the triad.
Yeah.
Because it is a different form.
And I think that's part of why I bristle at this too. I mean, I do think at this point, you know, we all very much love each other, but I think at the time during, you know, at the start of the time where maybe we would first be identifiable as a triad, I don't know that they were close enough to each other to really say they loved each other. So I think the presumption is that, oh, well, that's the man, obviously. He's the V, he's the center. But I think that's not only is that not true now, if you looked for a time where maybe there was any hint of there being someone in the middle, it would not have been the man.
Yeah.
And so I just, yeah.
Well, look, so
the triangle is very different from the V.
Right.
Let's get some things clarified here.
Sure.
Number one,
at least from my perspective.
Please don't hold back on calling out anything.
Okay.
That's the whole point of this. Number two, as a professional interviewer, I'm going to ask you questions and make smart-ass comments because I'm trying to put myself in a position of people.
That's fine, yeah.
And as far as, like, what you're describing, I can tell you this, and so you guys get some of my background.
Mm-hmm.
I feel so comfortable with my intimacy with men, exactly the way that you're describing, that... The question of my sexuality has been brought up quite often, mm-hmm. not just by my own family, my own friends growing
I've
up.
I've had that too.
No. Mm-hmm. I really like Madonna. That might have been a thing that made people think that. I feel I've never felt any sort of discomfort showing affection for other men. And it was, that may have been sort of like, again, for me personally, what led me to start learning in the past couple of years, the different ways there are to love the women in my life that may not actually involve any sort of sexuality. And you're saying, yeah, a man cannot, you know what, I'm not going to say cannot, doesn't really do much for me sexually, but at the same time, I don't feel uncomfortable around another man either.
You know, most men don't for me either, mm-hmm. or most women. Like, yeah. I don't know, gender's just not the most important deciding factor in whether or not someone is in fact attractive. I don't think for anyone, actually. For some people, maybe it's a little more important than for other people. But I, you know.
I mean, history has shown us that it is probably more fluid than we give it credit for. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not by any stretch of the imagination an expert on like Roman history, Greek history, but I mean, my understanding is that, you know, there was very much a time where we did have a class of the Romans who did see like women for procreation and like male love as like real love. But even then you still have like various different definitions of what love is. And again, personally, I've experienced in the past couple of years what it's like to really fall in love with a female, some women that I have in my life, I mean, deeply in love with, but that I don't feel the need to go rip their clothes off and throw them up against the wall. Like, that part's not there, but then the love I feel for them is still something that's not quite like the same as I have for another one of my female friends, or my cousin, for that matter. You know, it's not, but it seems like a lot of it does go back to sort of language, like you were saying earlier, like the word husband. You know, we only have this word love. We have in love or love.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And we don't have enough other words to describe the various kinds of it.
We've got the biggest lexicon in all the world. 500,000 words in the English language, love.
Yeah.
Great. Sanskrit has like 20 different words. The Greeks had at least 3, maybe 10.
Yeah.
We have others.
Well, we do, but we don't use them.
Sure.
Right?
Not so much.
We use love for everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd love a burrito right now. That's not the same thing. But that's a problem. It's not so much that we don't have the words.
Yeah.
But we don't use them in common context. We don't have a shared context for various kinds of love.
Yeah.
So,
a script for them. I mean, I think this gets back to the script conversations you were talking about earlier. That idea of, you know, being able to have, you know, a non-scripted kind of connection with someone, or maybe you feel in love with them, but you don't feel an overwhelming sexual impulse. It's hard to fit that in
to a
lot of, you know, normal expectations for the shapes your relationships take.
And without that, we don't know what to do. We're floundering.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
you have to invent it. And that's a challenge.
The first couple of times I felt what you're describing, I like went ahead and moved forward with my same old cheap moves because I'm like, oh, well, I'm feeling this thing. So obviously it means sex is next. And then thankfully she saw through that. thankfully it has become like, you know, this beautiful friendship that we've developed. Again, something much deeper than what could have been if it was, you know, a hookup. But I want to go back to sort of what we were discussing a little earlier. And this is, again, my feeling as an interviewer, trying to be a voice for people who are not in the room. My experience has been that a lot of people are, of course, very open and accepting and super, like, it's beautiful, you're in a triad, it's beautiful, you're in a polyamorous relationship, that's great. But they, a lot of times people don't really have an idea of how that actually works, like, logistically. Mm-hmm. If I'm trying to, I don't know, I want my girlfriend to bring me lunch because I forgot to pack it, and she happens to be on break, and she's able to take a longer break than I am. Which one do you text? When you're trying to plan out your Friday night, does one of you get jealous about the other one? About, like, or do you all three go out at the same time?
Yeah.
Simple, silly, dumb logistics. I swear these are the things that a lot of people find extra confusing because they have not been deep.
Those are the rocks that we end up ground upon.
I mean, I think most of the time it works out fairly easiest, right? I mean, most of the time one of them works in your neighborhood. One person works in your neighborhood and it's convenient for that one person. It might not be convenient for anyone else. Or maybe there's someone who has the day off from work, and so it's convenient for that person. Or, I don't know. I mean, I share my Google Calendar with four people right now, and only one of them is someone I'm currently dating.
Right. Exactly. None of the people that I'm dating, in other words, having sex with.
Right.
Do I share my calendar with? Do I share it with my life partner, my ex-wife? I share it with one other woman that I've had that had been I would consider a lover, even though we haven't had sex in a couple of years, for 12 years. Mm-hmm. We share calendars. Mm-hmm. I didn't share it with my last partner, but not with the new ones. They haven't gotten to that level.
And
I brought out my phone to look at. Okay, how many of these people have I texted in the last few hours?
Mm. Right.
Communication and calendaring, man.
Sure, and it depends. I mean, I don't. You know, sometimes my calendar isn't shared with people because I don't have that level of intimacy with them, and sometimes it's not because they're not calendar people.
Right.
Mm. There'd be no point in doing that. They just don't use that technology, you know, ongoing group text conversations with some people and, you know, other people I text individually. And it just, I don't know, it depends on how those people do their scheduling and how our lives end up aligning together and how, you know, it's boring. It comes down to scheduling and preferences for technology and, you know, what neighborhood people live in and whether they take the bus or drive and like boring junk like that. Like it just, you know, it's all kind of practical stuff a lot, most of the time.
Yeah, yeah. I imagine one of the things that I've actually heard these conversations many times too. Like, one of the things that a lot of people do wonder is, you know, what about an example of secrets? Who do you share your secrets with? Are you ever in a situation where one person is involved in a secret and another one isn't?
I don't really have secrets.
I try my hardest to never have secrets. If I have to withhold something, or even worse, if I have to lie about something, it inevitably backfires on me. I try so hard to not do that.
Yeah, I'm not really good at... I mean, sure, I can keep like a surprise party type secret.
Right, well,
kind of,
yeah.
A little bit. And I mean, I guess the only examples might be like someone else's confidence, but in that case, you know, I keep it absolutely. The only people who hear about it are the people who that person wants to.
Right. But I strain against having one partner who really, really wants to keep things very private between the two of us, and having other partners who really want to be able to freely exchange something and want to meet my other partners. Mm-hmm. And when you get into that dynamic, as I am right now with one who's kind of reticent about that, I don't know how it's going to evolve.
Mm-hmm.
And it will evolve, but I don't know how it's going to evolve. I mean, it's just going to change. The shape of this thing is going to change because it is not sustainable this way for me for very long. I'm a very public person. Maybe it's because of my generation. I live on Facebook. I mean, I probably post 3 or 4 times a day on average. I have 1,800 friends. I'm very out about who I am. And right now I have 3 lovers and I am not public about any of them in deference to one of them who is leery of the whole thing.
Mm.
That is a strain for me. It does not feel like I'm in integrity. And also I recognize that there's part of me that just is a show off and wants to talk about it all the time. I mean, truly. I mean, I recognize. I'm not sure which is the truth.
Yeah.
Thank you for providing the opportunity, right? But I would like to proclaim to the rooftops, I love you. This person that I'm not talking about here in this podcast because I can't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yet there's deep intimacy there. And so this is another one of the quandaries. I mean, there's, in addition to communication and calendaring, is what degree of openness? You know, are you keeping a secret, or are you simply respecting the other person's needs for safety?
Yeah.
Because she or he is in a situation where it might be threatening to them to be outed, as it were.
Sure. I think that's another potential point of jealousy, as you mentioned. I mean, there are things that I don't mention at work because of the nature of my work, but otherwise I don't really have secrets. I tend to mention anything to anyone, and, you know, I have, including, you know, many close friends, and I might not get around to talking to all my partners about big things because I might have told three people by the time I see them again, and then I don't really want to mention it, tell that story a fourth time, so they don't hear about it right away. But I think this actually happened recently with a partner where there were several things that were happening in their life that had to do with like getting a new job or considering moving out of San Diego a year or two in the future, but still. And it was two or three things I heard about first from someone else before I heard about it from them. And I got really hurt about it because I felt like, you know, these are things that could impact my life too. We just had a conversation about it. It was okay. You know, you just have to talk to people when stuff like that happens, and it's okay. But to me, that can be a big source of jealousy also at times, feeling like you're not kind of let into somebody's life. Mm-hmm. But usually it seems like when that happens, still the reason is boring. It's usually not, oh, I was withholding from you. It's been a really busy week, and the times we hung out, we were exhausted and we watched Netflix and fell asleep. You know, it's not something dramatic usually.
Right. And this is the power, the problem with the human imagination. If we are not secure in about ourselves, you don't love yourself, or don't feel secure about yourself, much less your relationships, the imagination takes hold, and suddenly, like you said an hour ago, he's holding her here, and
she's bent over. She's always bent over.
Yeah,
absolutely. Right? Where my male ego takes the most.
Oh, jeez. I mean. And that's, they're probably sitting across from each other at a dining room table, but,
the truth is never as exciting.
No, this is why we indulge in fantasy. Yeah. I mean, I have a long-term, a long-distance, long-term relationship with a woman in Calgary. And if she weren't 20 years younger with kids in Calgary, we'd probably be together all the time. But, we're at very different stages and places. But we spend a ton of time just exchanging fantasies because we play that way. And on the rare occasions we actually physically get together, it's marvelous, but the fantasies aren't what we do. That's just where the imagination goes. And so sometimes it's fun, and sometimes it tears you apart because it's your fear driving the fantasy instead of playfulness or creativity.
Flip sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always last way longer in sexting than I ever do, like, in person.
Oh, God, yes.
It's never going to last that long in real life.
I feel like my real life is actually pretty awesome, but...
you should write a book.
For those of us who live alone in a little studio apartment, it's a whole different game. So this is where a lot of the questions and the conversation we've been having leads to in my mind. What I've been looking for is sort of, this has been my experience as an artist and as an interviewer. There's always the surface thing that we're discussing. And then when you dig deeper and deeper and deeper, there's something way deeper that creates that thing. And that's the core of what I'm trying to get to. And really the universal truth that is something that we can all connect to. So with polyamory, for example, we can sit here and discuss the logistics of, triad and open relationships and veto power and all this stuff. But really it seems like a lot of it is tracing back to is, like you guys were saying, I have no secrets. Ethics, a strong sense of self. It's not so much that in order to practice polyamory, you have to do these things. It's that what attracts you to the idea of non-monogamy being an option on your table is that you're already practicing these things.
I really like that.
Yes.
Yeah. I think a lot of times people say, you have to really know yourself and communicate well to have a good polyamorous relationship. Sure. I think you have to really know yourself and communicate well to have a good relationship of any kind.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe there's some extra pressures that come from non-monogamy, but I think I really like that way of saying it, that being very driven by those things and spending a lot of time there kind of opens you up to the idea that you don't want to follow the scripts, right?
Yeah. I have a friend of mine who was exploring, she was one of the examples that I gave earlier, was just by coincidence, I'd had multiple females in my life that had this particular thing happen. And she was dating somebody who identified as polyamorous. And so she was hanging out with all these new people, and she's like, God, if I hear one more fucking person quote the ethical slut, I'm going to pull my hair out. And that always cracked me up because I feel like the experience that she was having, whether valid or not, traced back to either her perception or the people that she was dealing with really were doing it the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes. It really, and it's, I feel like to explore non-monogamy and to even be open to that idea, you kind of have to have, it would be ideal to have an 8th degree black belt in self-awareness.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels like a lot of times people are attracted to the physical perks.
Mm-hmm.
And then afterwards, they're trying to chase the other thing. Yes.
Yeah, I think that, yeah.
So what is, I guess the question is like, so how does that work? Like, does it matter what brings you to the party? I mean, is everybody invited to the party?
I mean, if by the party you mean like my personal relationships, no. I think it matters in that sense. It matters in terms of like who, say, I personally am going to choose to want to have certain kinds of relationships with. But I don't think that it matters in the sense that people can't get, that you can't get there from here. I wouldn't say that, right? I think coming at it from the other way, as you put it, can work for people.
Because I imagine, yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, the people that you dated who initially had no experience with this world, but then fell very comfortably into it, I imagine you sensed with them that they had the other side of it figured out.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Whereas, in fact, probably my first two... Or two of my first, my very first significant relationship with someone who was identified as poly before I met them. And then subsequently another fairly serious relationship with someone who is identified as poly. Both of those relationships unraveled due to jealousy on their part. Them not, you know, having trouble grappling with their own feelings of jealousy and insecurity and feeling like they need a distance from our relationship as a result.
Yeah.
I'm still very close friends. Those people are both huge figures in my life. I'm still very close friends with them, but I had never had that issue in relationships before, mm-hmm. when I was having open relationships with people who had never heard of it.
Hmm.
And so I think that speaks to, you know, I started dating someone who was already identified as polyamorous and had been doing it for a while. And I thought, oh, this is going to be a breeze, but no.
That's what my last relationship was like, too. Right. I mean, okay, it all looks good on paper, but then suddenly the triggers got raised and shot, and everything was painful.
Yeah.
Well, I love those triggers.
Oh, man, yeah.
Because, you know, you're dating the person, and then you're also, to some extent, dating everybody they've ever dated.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And
their parents too.
Absolutely. It's something all of a sudden shows up in your relationship that, you know, even I had this experience recently where I had no idea this wound existed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where the fuck did this come from? But some exchange you have. And you know what? Ultimately, I guess part of what I would like to say, because of course we have a lot of listeners who don't necessarily... they're cool with other people having this life, but, you know, it's probably not for them, which is fine. What I've always said is that, you know, time is, like, love is not limited.
Time is limited. Yeah.
So, you know, you might find that exploring non-monogamy is not really on your schedule because perhaps you're super career-driven, like, you're super lost and so-and-so, because it is going to take time.
Mm-hmm.
You have to sit there and have conversations that you normally would not have and explore parts of you and perhaps get into therapy and start meditating. You know, and there's all these things that you might not have time for right now, and that's okay.
It's true. I mean, you know, of course, that's one of the slogans of non-monogamy. And I sure, that's right. You know, time is not not an ending, and neither is, you know, emotional energy, I guess. But I think there are benefits as well that are often overlooked, even in terms of time, to non-monogamy. I think that there are, you know, I've known couples who have opened up exactly because of an imbalance in how much alone time one partner needed, and they recognize that, oh, maybe actually, you know, trying to be the only people who are intimately important to one another isn't going to work for us because of the problems of, you know, differential time availability or something. And that's worked out for them. And I think that's, you know, that's a possibility. And sometimes when those kinds of resources are strained, not being monogamous can actually be a good thing. I think there have definitely been times where I've felt really comforted that the people I love most have other people who they love who can be there for them at a time when I can't.
Yes.
And especially if that can be someone that you're also close to. That, I mean, this is sort of the new thing about being
That's what I'm, something I'm really like, seeking personally. I really want to connect in particular with one lover's, with a metamor there.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in a difficult position when we first met. And when I tried to reach out to him, he said, no, no, this is scary. I don't want to talk to him. But they have since reconciled, and now he's recognizing, oh, yeah, I think this would be a good thing. And I'm really looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
Because we both care for her very deeply. And I don't know the man. I don't know what he's going to be like.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm hoping that we can advance the amount of trust and the amount of love that she feels from both of us.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be good for all of us. And will increase the sense of safety and love and ease in all in the dynamic, however it evolves.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't had that experience before. That's something I've always wanted.
You know? It's pretty great.
I imagine it is. And I'm going to say I'm a little envious. I use that word envy. When we were talking really early on about jealousy,
mm-hmm.
And I said that I feel jealousy when my partner is having fun and I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm having fun too, I don't care what she's doing. I don't even call that word jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
I call that envy, because I want to make the distinction of, I don't feel that she should stop doing what she's doing. I just wish I were doing something too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I want that for me,
mm-hmm.
but I don't begrudge it.
My feeling on it is that we as a culture are all moving towards non-monogamy. I want you guys' opinions on this, and I'll tell you where mine is coming from. I think that within our lifetimes we're going to see artificial intelligence and virtual reality get to such a level of realism that you'll have monogamous or couples that may have historically identified as monogamous be in a situation where they're like, hey, you're literally dating this entity that just may have been created in a virtual world that can interact with you and that you can be intimate with and you can share experiences with.
Witness the movie Her.
I have not actually seen that yet.
I haven't seen it either.
You would love it.
I definitely want
to.
That's on the Netflix list.
Yeah. Me too.
but what's going to happen is that those lines are going to get so blurred that the people that are in these, that might have been historically monogamous, they're going to question some of those things. And I want to know, like, is this a thought that even comes to your mind as having being individuals who are just simply living this life? This isn't something you're analyzing every 2 seconds. Like, oh, part of this community. Like, I know, it's just life.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to work in the morning, you're coming home, there's your partners. I wonder, like, do you ever have any thoughts about this, about where this is going? Is it like, wow, like right now I'm one of the weirdos, but in a few years, it's going to be a lot more of us.
I think there are going to be a lot more of us. But just as the internet creates community and brings people into empathy, empathic connection with one another to some extent, the deeper, the richer the information flow, the greater the possibility for empathy. And there's nothing that substitutes for in-person. I mean, we can all feel a lot more about one another here than the listeners listening to this podcast can truly feel about us. But it also provides the opportunity to create walls and dismiss ideas. I mean, we're seeing both the growth of groups and influence. I mean, I have far more empathy with a Syrian refugee than I have with someone who believes that they should be shut out, because I understand, I have a feeling for their pain. I don't have any feeling for the guy who's afraid of them, because it doesn't make any sense to me. That simply feels like irrational fear. And they're suffering, real suffering. But nonetheless, we both bring together, but we also creating walls. So when the singularity happens, is it going to magically transform all of us so that these walls start falling down? I don't think so.
Hey, you can tweet me directly at Mr. Arash, and when discussing the show, please do use the hashtag #BurnerPodcast. You can catch me on the Crappy Awesome Podcast. It's a weekly interview show and a staple in the independent hip-hop community for over 4 years and over 200 episodes. Find that over at platformcollection.com. Platformcollection.com is the podcast network that is on. Burner Podcast is up on Libsyn and SoundCloud. First, Libsyn is the broadcasting platform and blah, blah, blah. You know what? You already heard all this during the break, so I'm just going to skip past it. Leave us some reviews on iTunes. Keep reminding you of that. Our intermission music is by Duckman. Please check out his music over at duckmansd.bandcamp.com. And if you're a musician in the community, tweet our music editor, Navjeet, at I am Navjeet. If you have any questions or thoughts for music and all that good stuff. The Burner Podcast theme song is America's Horse with No Name remix produced by Joman. Check out his stuff over at soundcloud.com/DJ Joman. This episode is produced by Meg King. If you have any questions or suggestions for future guests, shoot them over to Meg King. She is on Twitter at @ThatMegKing. Our online editor is Tanasi. He writes and curates the blog. You can reach him by shooting him a message at burnerpodcast.com in the contact page. Hope you will join us next time. We do release new episodes on the first and third Wednesdays of the month. So until next time, love and light and all that other crap. Good night.